This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
Thank you for waiting for our inexcusable belatedness. So it's with great pleasure that I want to welcome Rebecca here. You probably heard or you know Eduardo Cadava, who's come quite regularly from Princeton to Slot. But it was when we knew that Rebecca was spending a whole semester at Princeton that we thought we could invite her. Let me say, if you don't know Eduardo, that he has written this wonderful book, Words of Light. Barth and Benjamin, and has also his book on Emerson and the climate of history, and an older project, Who Comes After the Subject, edited with Jean-Luc Nancy. He teaches English at Princeton, and Rebecca is a philosopher, and she teaches at Toronto. She has published quite a number of very important articles on Hegel, Benjamin, and is working on two books in progress, Mourning, Sickness, Hegel, and the Possibility of Memory, and another book, Benjamin's Losses Between Melancholia and Fetishism. The point of departure I'd like to take tonight for this really freewheeling discussion on the question of revolution, the concept of revolution, is the recent publication of the South Atlantic Quarterly, edited by Eduardo, Justice for All, the Claims of Human Rights. a good Freudian lapsus, Freudian slip. In this superb collection that has texts by Derrida, Gayatri Spivak, and many others, Rebecca Cormier has published a beautiful essay called Dead Right, Hegel and the Terror. And we thought we would start from this particular moment, that is, her analysis of how Hegel sees the terror linked with the French Revolution, which is something that is quite crucial for the economy of the phenomenology of spirit. And I just say this briefly for those of you who may have read Hegel. I think there are basically two camps of commentators, those who take this text, this passage very seriously, and those who prefer not to read it too much. And I think, for instance, part of the weakness of the reading of Hegel by Kojève, who was so influential in France in the 1930s, was that he didn't pay much attention in his political reading to the analysis of the terror. One central question, and maybe Rebecca could in a way sum up the argument, but one central issue is whether the terror, which started more or less when the king was guillotined, was an accident, or was it in a way inscribed in the French Revolution. This is, of course, part of the general drift of Eduardo's introduction to the issue of human rights, since the first official proclamation of the human rights was connected with the French Revolution. So all these issues are, I think, linked, and at least this is something that we could ask Rebecca maybe to rapidly, if you want, to go back to your own argument and your own analysis of Hegel, and then perhaps start with other questions connected.
Okay, well, maybe we can just start with this very specific question concerning the extent to which revolution and terror are conceptually or even chronologically coextensive as seen from across the river, say, let us say from the perspective of a German cultural sphere, which at that point felt themselves to be inherently immune from revolutionary upheaval themselves, precisely by virtue of having been immunized against revolution by virtue of their own cultural revolution, which they identified with the Protestant Reformation. So in other words, having achieved a kind of secularization of faith, that is say, a way of having achieved a kind of freedom of conscience, a freedom in faith, the project of enlightenment had already taken root within a cultural sphere which preempted or made unnecessary the need for political material solutions. So this is a strand we find running throughout throughout philosophy of the epoch, you know, around the turn of the century, as Germany observed this event, which was continually described in theatrical terms as a kind of spectacle, as a kind of tragedy, as a kind of drama, something which could be whose fruits could be appreciated from afar by virtue of the fundamental position of Germany as a witness capable of being a witness, not simply by virtue of historical geographical distance, but by virtue of the fact that the event had already been processed in some way conceptually. So the issue, you know, the issue of the terror specifically, can you have a revolution without terror? To what extent does terror define the revolution? Is broached in so many different ways, and it's interesting to compare on this precise point Hegel, for example, to Kant, who's writing essentially at the same time, maybe a few years earlier, but who in the name of a philosophy of history which is committed to the idea of continual, of history being the site or the medium, the bodily medium of continual moral progress, is confronted with this event which presents itself as a kind of eruption of irrationality, certainly in Kant's own terms, insofar as the very foundation of the state is overturned, and sort of the continuity of right, of legally sanctioned rule has been interrupted. And this interruption presented by the spectacle of the king's legally sanctioned beheading in January of 1792 presents this kind of a crisis for a philosophy of history which is seeking continuity. And so as Kant continues to sort of worry about this event, you see this strenuous effort to reduce the scope of the terror, to mitigate its force in such a way that the revolution can be conceptually appreciated as being compatible with progress, with human rational progress, by siphoning off the terroristic aspects to an ever decreasing sphere, so that the sphere of terror becomes more and more minute as Kant's analysis proceeds. It doesn't have to do with the storming of the Bastille. It doesn't have to do with the seizure of power by the National Assembly. It doesn't have to do with the proclaiming of a revolution itself, with the deposing of the king. It doesn't even necessarily have to do with, the terror doesn't even necessarily get linked conceptually or exhaustively with the killing of the king, at least insofar as this latter event could be understood and therefore put in its place as a kind of eruption of libidinal passion motivated by fear or revenge or simple caution through all the mitigating circumstances that were abundant. So insofar as the regicide could be understood as a kind of assassination attempt motivated by some kind of pathological interest, it can be comprehended and contained within a progressive, optimistic philosophy of history. What for Kant marks the terror as this uncontainable fissure within the continuum of history is the legal sanctioning of that event. That there were law courts, that there was a trial, that the execution seemed to follow the rule of law as such. This is what marks this event as essentially terroristic, and introduces into the revolution itself its essentially revolutionary force. Up until then, revolution can be described as essentially evolution, one thing leading to another, and contained within a conceptual continuum. So revolution is linked to terror by Kant. That is to say, evolution turns into revolution at the moment that it becomes terrorizing. But what's important is that this eruption is chronologically and conceptually contained and confined to a very small event. Now, Hegel, writing just a few years later, really has the opposite approach. The terror is continuous, coextensive with the entire sphere of the revolution, which is a revolution. And it begins, you don't have to wait till the official terror of 1793, 1794, when terror actually becomes an explicitly valorized word for the probably only time in history, becomes an officially sanctioned term by government linked to virtue. And it doesn't begin with the king's beheading. It doesn't begin with the proclamation of the republic. It doesn't begin with storming Bastille. It begins the moment that the Etats Généraux transform themselves into the National Assembly, and thereby constituting themselves as a nation with a singular, unified voice, appropriate for themselves the authority previously invested in this divinely sanctioned king. And what's terroristic about that is not simply that it's democracy, or that it's no longer monarchy. What marks this event as terroristic in Hegel's analysis is that with this identification of sovereignty with a homogeneous corporate nation, a nation which defines itself as exhaustive and exclusive, therefore logically unable to tolerate an outside, including an internal outside, including internal dissension or differentiation, you have this metaphysics of death already instantiated, insofar as you have a politicization of an eradication of objectivity, that is, of externality, of difference, which has as its logical culmination an expression, the guillotine, which Hegel analyzes in terms of this radical suppression of individuality. So the individual, insofar as it is different from the collectivity, has to be identified. I mean, has to be identified as a suspect, and the suspicion has to be acted out literally by way of a killing, which is at once infinitely particularizing. I mean, identifies the suspect and therefore singles it out from the collectivity as being other than collective, at once supremely particular and inherently collective. The death is anonymous, it's the same, it's factory produced, it's mechanical, it's the same for everyone, the bodies can't be buried, they all dissolve into the quicklime and so on. And this is the basic contradiction which Hegel is intent on hunting down. So on the one hand, a contradiction which is fundamental to the revolution as such. So there's a fundamental tension here between a liberal reading of the revolution, let's say Kant's, which would separate revolution from its precipitation into terror, And a Hegelian reading, which sees terror as being entirely the domain of revolution as being coextensive with the domain of terror. And I think one of the challenges that a reading of Hegel has to face is what distinguishes that equation or identification of revolution and terror with the standard conservative readings of Burke, De Mast, and everybody who saw terror on the horizon as soon as the storm. What is the distinction between Hegel's reading and a monarchist reading, which led to this seemingly similar conclusion?
Indeed, I was thinking of things you were mentioning, Kant, and I know we had started a discussion around this issue, the debate between Kant and Benjamin Constant about the right to lie for humanitarian reasons, defended by Constant. For Constant, the point was that one should distinguish between the absolute principles that, as such, because of that abstraction, and it's a sort of he runs parallel to the analysis of Hegel, lead to absolute death, death the absolute master, and what he sees in the name of humanity as the right, for instance, to lie, to save somebody, a friend, and also connected with the idea for Constant, and which was that of the liberals at that time, the idea that one should absolutely be able to dissociate 1789 from 1793. That is, that there was no link between state terror and the law on suspects, that is, any person suspected of being an enemy could be executed. There's a little anecdote that I had found a few years ago in a Paris guide about an old duchess, I think, who was brought to Fouquier-Tinville and who was the public accuser. And the guard said, well, look, she's very old, she's 70 years old, she's deaf, she's blind, she doesn't understand anything, you should spare her. So Fouquier-Tinville, writing the sheet of paper that led her to the guillotine, wrote, she has been for 70 years blindly and deathly conspiring against the nation. She was sent to death. So this idea that anybody who is a suspect is caught up in the machine, indeed, and there's a machinic element that is that. But in a way, what you're trying to show, and anticipating maybe on a Marxian reading, is that Hegel goes back somehow and in a way would not distinguish, but in a sense differently than Kant, between 89 and 93, as if there was a terror inherent to the negativity of the unleashing of absolute freedom. Is that something that you would see as a, let's say, leading to the 19th century and to the Marxian concept of the revolution, that the revolution must be a bloody act, must imply having, you know, heads rolling in the dust, or not?
I think I'd like to maybe follow that up and return to something that Rebecca was saying when she was talking about just the general issue of can there be revolution without terror? And then marking the difference between Kant and Hegel. And I think that what I've liked about the essay, but also about other moments in that discussion, has to do with the way in which Hegel seems to, the extent to which, let's say, Hegel, but also Kant, but differently, respond to the French Revolution in such a way that they become, they work to articulate a kind of philosophy of revolution. And they incorporate and encrypt the rhetoric of revolution, but also the force of revolution within their own writing. And it seems that one of the things that happens if you take the Hegelian reading of revolution and its relation to terror is that the story that Hegel wants to tell becomes a story wherein consciousness, the story of consciousness, the moment when consciousness turns back on itself and retrospectively grasps its own progression by confronting death and nothingness. And there's a way in which it recognizes its own becoming in revolution. Right? So that it's the moment of terror, and I think maybe this is just to repeat what Jean-Michel was saying, the moment of terror, the moment when absolute freedom changes into its opposite and comes to be identified with death and nothingness, that moment of terror enters into the process by which freedom becomes necessity. So there's a way in which the terror is always already there. It's behind us, it's within us, and terror, in fact, becomes the precondition for the emancipatory process. And is that something that you seem that's the direction in which you seem to be going?
Well, this is what would mark, one of the respects in which Hegel's analysis of terror as being identical to revolution would be distinct from a conservative or monarchist reading articulated of that same identification, because as you've said, that identification is necessary for Hegel, but it is the essential occasion for. For the emancipation of consciousness as such. So the revolution, not despite but in its terrorizing and self-terrorizing negativity, becomes the essential occasion for consciousness to reflect upon itself and eventually for consciousness to develop a theory of revolution. Hegel, according to Hegel's analysis, the subsequent, not only does the subsequent course of German philosophy get interpreted as a kind of philosophical rendering of revolution, a project of affirming a kind of autonomy in thought, which has just been played out on the stage of history, but German philosophy retroactively becomes, for the first time, legible after the revolution. So Kant becomes legible as giving the conceptual form of revolution itself, the Copernican revolution, which was a term which had been used innocuously, suddenly acquires political force. As a kind of retroactive response to and inspiration for the revolutionaries who had never met him, of course, at the time.
In your article, you try to show that for Hegel and let's say the those who have meditated on the French Revolution and on terror, there's the idea that the German thinkers and maybe people as such has been in a way inoculated or will avoid the mistake of the French. And you compare this with the Freudian terms of melancholia, that would be the French, in a way, impossibility of abandoning something, a certain link with death, and the German people being capable of mourning the loss that is always implied there. But also this being based, I suppose, for Hegel, on this idea that the German are less naive than the French, in a way. They don't have to enact it like that and start killing everybody off like that to see whether
they
freedom...
they rushed into it without thinking.
Yeah.
Well, the Germans are operating, this is something that Marx will take up and inflect an entirely different direction, but the Germans are operating on a different, according to a different clock and a different calendar. So on the one hand, there is no revolution now. I mean, it's happening at their gates, but it's not of this time for Germany. and it's not of this time because it's all, you know, on the one hand, Germany's already, it's already been through it, so it's old hat for Germany. It's been through its Reformation several hundred years before. The church has been effectively secularized, that is to say, God doesn't stand any longer as an external figure of dogmatic coercion, yeah. And nor do the priests. So we have with the internalization of religious authority in conscience, the issue of autonomy has already been worked through, and so we don't have this literalism, you know, whereby churches are either torn down or converted into temples of reason or institutions and so on. We don't have to, you know, take away, you know, people's Christian names and replace them with Roman names. You know, all these literal de-Christianization strategies which were practiced in the French Revolution are a symptom of an unprocessed relationship to a religion which, you know, because it hasn't been worked through and given up, sort of the transcendent coercive force of religion has not been given up. It's simply been transferred, you know, onto a different terrain. This power returns with all its oppressive force. So Germany doesn't need it. I mean, it's already had it, and so it's not going to happen now. And by that same token, actual material revolution, let's say a change in social circumstances, let's say, can be deferred indefinitely. So on the one hand, the revolution qua Reformation has always already happened. On the other hand, there's this consciousness of a kind of what Herder and Schlegel both refer to in one or two places as the other revolution, which is still to come, this fundamental transformation of spiritual existence, which seems to be connected with some kind of avant-garde moment, and transformation of literature, which is going to have the same kind of import. And that can be deferred to an ever-receding future. So it's not that the now is not the time of revolution. Revolution is either past or future. And with it, we have this, you know, and with this thought, we have this shifting of calendars and clocks, such that we can have philosophical revolution in the place of some kind of, you know, material change of circumstances, and hence the compulsive charting of analogies between this moment of philosophy and that moment of revolution, whereby, for example, in Heine, who wrote after Hegel, in Heine we have this, you know, this identification of Kant's philosophy with the first moment of the revolution, 1789. We have Fichte occupying the place of the convention, let us say, when the terror kind of institutionalized itself. We find Hegel representing this kind of post Thermidorian consolidation, i.e. Napoleon, okay. And we find Schelling representing this restoration backpack. So we have this sort of, he's kind of joking, but kind of not, where, you know, philosophy, all the tropes of philosophy become tropes of politics and vice versa.
But I think maybe what is, for me at least, as a French man, one of the most bizarre things of the French Revolution is this return of this abstract religion of the supreme being, and you go back to that, which is indeed, it leads to the Hegelian analysis of the link between the revolution and the need for something that is a religion of a sort of emptiness, supreme being. It's not, of course, and at that same time, all the priests were being killed, of course. So there's something that's extremely curious, and you quote in passing Hegel's earlier texts in which he accuses basically Moses of being the first terrorist of the absolute, when Moses took his people into the desert and started slaughtering a number of them you know, famous story of the tables of the law and Aaron's world in the story is important. But behind Moses, I think one could also see Kant. Anyway, he's attacking Kant and accusing Kant of being a sort of abstract thinker of duty for duty's sake, and therefore of alienation and oppositions between two abstract opposites that will never be reconciled, therefore will create. How can one think, you know, in today's language, can one think of religion, a revolution without religion? Or is it something that you would try to keep apart? Or, you know, if one thinks of oneself as a revolutionary, can one be a revolutionary and avoid fundamentalism of any sort?
There are also ways in which people have often identified revolution with a certain kind of secularization, right? So the de-Christianization and so on. So that,
right.
It's the same question, right? Can there be revolution that would not secularize? It's the same other side of the question, I think.
Yeah, but we know that, you know, Danton and a few others were beheaded because they were precisely too irreligious and it was bad for the Montagnard. It was really worse than being a suspect. But how would you see, in a way, the presence of this kind of ghost of the religion, of the old religion, in any revolution? How do you conceptualize this, since I think it's something we might have, you know, be more attentive to today, in view of the return of all the many fundamentalisms, at times in the name of a possible revolution, at times, you know, think of Iran 20 years ago. And so.
Or the New York Times today, which mentioned that now with the Bush victory, that the conservative right and religious groups were declaring that now is the time for a revolution. And they defined the revolution in terms of reversing Roe versus Wade, putting Scalia to direct the Supreme Court, that this was declared, it's named a revolution.
But interestingly, a revolution which is, you know, fundamentalist
yes.
in its content, but which seems to need to prop itself up with reference to this other fundamentalism. So that is to say, Muslim fundamentalism, which it is not. So it's a fundamentalism which cannot present itself as such, only vis-a-vis, you know, a kind of a fanaticism which is on the outside and somewhere else. And so there's a fundamental tension within the, you know, within the very appropriation of the idiom of revolution within a supposedly secular society,
right.
You know, whose own, you know, fundamentalist presuppositions are rising to the surface, and can only it can only express itself by way of this sort of massive disavowals of what it's doing by projecting it onto the other.
But can one say can a revolution succeed? Broad question. But from your own.
Am I the expert here?
Or, you know, is it necessarily taken up in this series of Freudian returns that you described relatively well? Can it be a break with the past, or can it lead us elsewhere?
Or can there be a definitive revolution, a final revolution, which is not immediately and logically implicated in the structures of repetition that Marx analyzes, you know, so eloquently, while, you know, seeming to hold on to the possibility of a final revolution, which will not, you know,
right.
just be another doubling of a previous failed revolution. You said no.
I said no. That, I mean, one of the things that Marx, I mean, it's true that he does talk about the overcoming of it, but he's also one of the great analysts of the repetition that belongs to revolution, right? And I think that one can talk about the history of the modern concept of revolution, because, of course, revolution didn't always mean the emergence of something new, right? It not only, I mean, from the Copernican and so on, I mean, repetition, revolution, from the skies and so on, but also the Glorious Revolution was not going to inaugurate something new. It was going to return us to, restore us to a preordained order of some kind that had been corrupted and so on. So that I think that when Marx analyzes revolution and he talks about the repetition without which revolution could never take place, I mean, repetition, revolution from the skies and so on, but also the Glorious Revolution was not going to inaugurate something new. It was going to return us to, restore us to a preordained order of some kind that had been corrupted and so on. So that I think that when Marx analyzes revolution and he talks about the repetition without which revolution could never take place, he's also, whether he means to deliberately or not, he's bringing with him the associations that belong to the older conceptions of revolution. I think it's only with maybe it's only with the French Revolution that revolution becomes attached to the possibility of the emergence of something new, and also associated with the aims of freedom. So it has to be both new and also aimed toward freedom. But I think that I mentioned to you earlier today that the opening of the 18th Brumaire, just to remind ourselves of it, is one of the great passages on the inevitability of repetition within Marx. Yeah, yeah. So.
But what of the American Revolution?
they were all reading Europeans. well, you know, Emerson, at the opening of his essay Nature, where he says, our age is retrospective, it builds the sepulchres of the fathers, and you know, the opening of Nature is always read as Emerson's plea that American writers shed off the burden of history and began to write a literature that would be peculiarly American. And so therefore, to enact a revolution that would have no precedent in some kind. His appeals for revolution are entirely citational, you know, so that the activity of appealing to a revolution that is unprecedented, that will inaugurate something new, is explicitly citational in Emerson. So that, for example, the opening of Nature, our age is retrospective, but builds the sepulchres of the fathers, is a allusion to Daniel Webster's 1825 speech at the groundbreaking ceremony of the Bunker Hill Monument, where Daniel Webster says, we are among the sepulchres of the fathers. We are among the sepulchres of our fathers. And you can begin to actually see the way in which Emerson, who is supposedly in Nature, in an American scholar, articulating the context and grounds for both an American and a literary revolution, is insistently repetitive. I mean, so that he, which is just to say, and I think this maybe we'll go back to Rebecca's reminder about Marx's hope, is that for something singular to occur, for something unprecedented to occur, it can only emerge and occur through what one inherits. And in that tension between the old and the new, that's where one has to talk about what's possible. I mean, I always am reminded of Gramsci's passage in The Prison Notebooks, where he says that the crisis lies precisely in the fact that the old is dying and the new cannot be born, and in the interregnum, a variety of morbid symptoms appear. So that what he's interested in is the way in which, at particular moments, things break in certain lines or in certain directions. And one of the things that he wants us to think about is why, at a particular moment, in this particular context, with these particular set of relations, did it break in this way rather than another one? Right? And I think that that's, it's never going to break all on its own. Right? And I think that when somebody like Kant, who very often evacuates the content of the revolution in order to read the French Revolution as what he calls a sign of history, one of the things that one can do is actually, okay, well, what does that mean? What is the sign of history? How do you read a sign of history? And how does an event like the French Revolution not only come to encourage us to think about what an event is, but also what history is? In order to do that, one has to engage in this kind of reconstruction of all the things that led to this moment, and you'll see that it didn't just fall from the sky. Right? And I think that to the extent it didn't fall from the sky, that is linked in some way to this repetitive, relational context. Mm-hmm. But,
yeah, I mean, this ties up very well with the discussion we had recently with Dorothy Alkowski, who was here, who was talking about the link between catastrophe theory and the revolution, as we are trying to describe it. Catastrophe theory trying to describe that moment in the system in which something suddenly breaks or mm-hmm. something collapses, and it's purely mathematic, but is also connected with issues, as you said, of the new literature, for instance, or technology. We speak of the Industrial Revolution, mm-hmm. technological revolution, and the exhibition that Aaron just finished installing, showing the work of Arakawa and Ginz, is also, I think, for them explicitly, in the name of a certain revolution, which has to go via a different way of living and building, and living in building, so as to, in their theory, avoid death, which is another kind of utopia.
Yeah, theirs is a revolution against death.
Yeah. But that leads me to this question of the, we were talking earlier about Blanchot's reading of Hegel, and in a number of essays, especially Literature and the Right to Death, written just after the war, if I'm not mistaken, he returns to this analysis of the terror, and after all, the Nazi terror in the Second World War was something similar. But he's trying to take into account this idea of the literary or artistic revolution as something that can create maybe another sense of community in his own utopia, that a revolution, at least according to Hegel, can never constitute, or at least that's what I understood from your analysis. Did you agree with that, that a revolution cannot create this kind of community of artists or innovators somehow?
Well, what Hegel is looking at is only what he knew in 1806, and he didn't have Blanchot to look at. So what he did have to look at were the avant-garde writers of his day, which were the Romantics, mm-hmm. And Hegel's Romantics are not Blanchot's Romantics. And so what he sees in this, what he sees and castigates in Romanticism, which he reads as a kind of literary aftermath, and historically he's not so far off, but I mean he's doing this conceptually, he's reading it as a literary aesthetic aftermath and processing of the kind of moralism that Kantian philosophy presents, which in turn he reads as a kind of philosophical processing of the revolutionary fever. So even though, you know, even though it was written before, it still reads as a processing of what came after. So in other words, when he, according to his reading, you have a failed political revolution, which makes conceptually legible a failed moral revolution, which makes necessary an artistic revolution, which founders on precisely the same grounds by Hegel's readings as the original, you know, so-called original revolution did itself, and this precisely by virtue of its aestheticism, what he would analyze as aestheticism. So the Romantics, you know, try to create this community, this community of private, isolated individuals, and form their groups and so on, and fall into, you know, precisely the same operations of suspicion as their political predecessors. So they're suspicious of everything. They hate the world. They're paranoid. They look to art to negate everything else, and their artwork suffers the same fate as the revolutionary buildings, which crumbled. I mean, there's artworks which never finish, which can't consummate themselves, which are constantly denying themselves. So there's a kind of guillotine logic that he identifies within the aesthetic avant-garde of his day, which would block any, you know, his analysis would block any appeal to art as a way of redeeming the failed promise of the revolution. This would mark his, you know, his great distinction from his later readers, such as Blanchot, who would see in the aesthetic possibilities which Hegel would forever block.
I would say, though, that, I mean, and maybe this, in terms of Blanchot, I think you're right, that for Blanchot, he does, it wouldn't be an exaggeration to say that he thinks communism in relation to a community of literature, right? Mm-hmm. And Nolcy has written about literary communism in Blanchot, and he is thinking about the activity of writing and the role of writing within the project of communism. But it's also clear that what one understands by this cannot be aligned either with the idea of communism or the idea of literature as we know it. And in that regard, what I would say is that if one goes back to Marx, there would be a way in which one could argue that that literature, in fact, plays an enormously important role in Marx, not only in his analysis of economics, politics, history, etc., but as something that's actually much more essential and fundamental to his project. And just as a kind of example, I would I'll give an example and then say something a little more. The earliest extant letter we have from Marx is a letter that he wrote to his father, and it's kind of like Kafka's letter to his father, where he's basically apologizing to his father for his interest and love in literature. And so what he does is he says that he's arrived at a turning point, right? So it is a moment that is a kind of a moment of change, possibly a moment of revolution for himself. He says he's arrived at a turning point, and at these moments, a person becomes lyrical. And in fact, the letter is extremely lyrical. And what he says is that at these moments are constituted both by a kind of farewell, a swan song, but also the need to write a great new poem. Right? So that what he talks about is at these moments of transition, these moments of alteration, possibly these moments of revolution, the need to both say farewell to something at the same time that you inaugurate something. And what the letter is actually describing is his farewell to literature. I'm going to stop writing poems, I'm going to start writing novels, drama, etc. I'm going to start reading law, politics, history, economics, because the classes that I've been taking, in fact, have been conflicting with my interests. It's an early version of class conflict. And what he tries to do is actually say that he wants to erect a memorial in order to honor what he's leaving behind. And I think one could argue that the memorial he erects is the rest of his corpus. And that it's not just the moments when he explicitly uses Balzac to analyze this or that feature, or when he uses Don Quixote in German ideology to analyze the young Hegelians. But I would say that it's maybe he's using these literary levers all the more when he's not talking about literature directly, but when he's talking about or analyzing hallucinations, phantasms, I mean, the mist of religion, all the things that one can associate with the literary. And I would say that there is a way in which you could argue that that Marx sees a very central role for literature in revolution. And in fact, the Blanchot, one of the arguments that Blanchot makes in his essay is that there can be no revolution without literature. Yeah. Right? But what that means, among other things, is that one has to revolutionize what one means by literature. Right? And for literature, I mean, for Marx, literature, what makes literature literature is that it's never simply itself. It's always already touched by history, politics, economics, etc. So that if you start revolutionizing what you think literature is, it seems to me that you could make a case for something literary being very essential to revolution.
Mm-hmm. And perhaps the mistake of a certain avant-garde, I'm thinking of the tensions in surrealism or French surrealism with the famous surrealism in the service, au service de la révolution. And this journal that I think was sort of wishful thinking, because at the same time, Breton and his friends could see that they couldn't join the French Communist Party. Mm-hmm. They couldn't do the kind of dreary analyses of economics and that were requested of them by their comrades. As we know, Breton led the party, and that led to a big split. And I think Blanchot is really thinking back to that moment when a certain group of friends was positing itself as a sort of avant-garde in the arts and literature, particularly, but also in the service of a revolution that they were hoping to see, but then the group couldn't function as a group and then became a collection of small sects fighting against one another in the name of the same terrorist tactics, exclusions, vituperations, pamphlets, ad hominem, and so on. But I agree that it seems to me that Blanchot's particular way of thinking this ideal avant-garde has always been to link it with politics without being, you know, in May 68 he was very active and he had left his own reserve, but otherwise he measured his interventions to a few very, very well-chosen tactical moments, which is not at all the position of the committed intellectual we've seen ad nauseam elsewhere. Maybe we could open this to the public if you have questions, interventions. We wanted this to be a general debate and not monopolize speech tonight.
Always already there that the revolution would bring to the present.
Well, I guess one issue is, can you break with the past without turning it into a kind of recent past, you know, relative to which there's some kind of deeper past, you know, to which you can refer yourself. Can you break with all of history, or must you break with the history which has a boundary, you know, and so therefore are you always in the position of seeking some kind of precursor? I mean, it's a big question, you know, why people always, historians always worry about why were the French Revolutionaries always, you know, invoking these classical forms, you know, down to their names and sometimes their clothing and their buildings, and, you know, why all this Greek and Latin Republican gestures throughout the, you know, certainly throughout the, you know, up to 1794 or so, when they were all told to change the names back again and, you know, go back to saints' names and, you know, whatever they're supposed to be doing. So why look back to the past in the name of this, you know, of a, you know, at a moment when time was thought to begin again? I mean, you have the year zero. You don't, you know, you have a complete, you have the, you know, a new chronology, a new measuring system, everything being introduced, you know, as if there was some kind of ex nihilo beginning. So what is the function of this, you know, of this antiquity? Is it because antiquity itself is seen as some kind of inaugural event, like sort of trying to recapture the idea of beginningness as such, so the need to invoke some kind of primal past in order to legitimate, not to give itself a pedigree, but in order to conceptualize what it means to begin? Can you think of a beginning without modeling yourself on a previous beginning? So for Marx, you know, who's quick to look at this, you know, so what's all this, you know, all these Roman costumes, you know, are just a symptom of the fact that of the fundamental anachronism of the French Revolution. They're anachronistically trying to reenact an old form of democracy, which is no longer, which doesn't fit the modern condition. I mean, democracy in the classical city of Greece and Rome was founded on, you know, the distinction between slaves and free men, such that the realm of work was completely distinct from the realm of politics. So those who were free to be political didn't have to work, and this rested on the whole economic productive sphere of those who were by definition not political. So the sort of the split between economics or work and, or in Marx's term, society and politics or the state was neat and clean in classical antiquity, and that's what made it, that's what gave its democracy the shape it had. So when the French invoke Greco-Roman forms, what was in fact happening is that their central modernity is being denied. I mean, they're acting as if you can separate society and politics or work and the domain of work and the domain of political freedom, in an era where in fact the political is founded upon social forms from which it cannot be divorced and which it has to constantly mask. So as such, the very appeal to ancient garb is a kind of ideological cloaking of a class division which cannot be openly acknowledged anymore. So that's just a very specific instance of a repetition which can be read in two entirely different ways.
Maybe it's in the arts that precisely you have, according to say Adorno, for instance, this idea that you have revolutions and they are irrevocable, as it were. They, Schoenberg is, of course, the example he always uses. Schoenberg has revolutionized the musical language, according to Adorno. And if you go back, like Stravinsky, you're really a reactionary. You misunderstand history. You misunderstand the dynamic of internal to the medium, to the language, and so on. Or you could think of somebody like Ezra Pound, who, even though he became a fascist, because he was looking for a revolution. And for a long time, he saw Lenin and Mussolini as two identical revolutionaries. And of course, that poses the question of all the reactionary revolutions. I think fascism pretended to be a revolution for a while, until it went back to all these classical pseudo-Roman discourse that would, in a way, put Mussolini on par with Latin emperors and so on. So it, here again, we have, especially through the 20th century, this constant recurrence of the sort of backsliding into the conservative or reactionary. But one is not obliged to accept Adorno's historical paradigm. Some people, I think someone like Benjamin had this famous discussion with Adorno on precisely this issue of progress. Because for Benjamin, I think this is where he's really perhaps closer to what we were trying to define here. If there is a revolution, it should be perhaps more on the theological and Jewish nature of, on the lines of some kind of messianism, in which it's the totally unexpected that should come. But precisely, it's so unexpected that it hasn't come yet. Still waiting.
So unexpected that we won't recognize it when
That's
it
right.
comes.
That's right. Yes.
When Winston was talking about the repetitious quality of revolution, which I guess Cuba is the last country that still talks about the language of revolution, particularly, reminded me also of the idea of the half-life. You know, so it's like this thing that's continually expanding energy, but it always has something left. Mm-hmm. And so then when you brought up the messianic quality, it was like, because it's anticipatory essence, it sort of does that as well. So it's kind of, I mean, there's these links. I mean, I wonder if you guys think there are these links somewhere.
Well, at least following, say, Benjamin and Derrida, you if you really want to think the revolution as revolution, you need to be on the side of the messianic, because otherwise, and this was I think Benjamin's argument facing Adorno, if you rely on a sort of idea of progress, you think you are a Marxist, but you just believe that it is inevitable, and then why have the revolution as we see it, with, you know, insurrections and storming the Winter Palace and all that, if it is just a matter of progress and letting history, you know, follow its course. So that there are a few letters in which he's quite ironical, facing the German proletariat that believes it's revolutionary when it's not, in fact. At least this has been a long debate in the history of, German socialism and Marxist and neo-Marxist and reformist socialism in Germany. But fundamentally, one has to go back to the religious, as it were, somehow, to at least with Benjamin, I think. It's quite crucial to have the Marxism, as he says, that has the theology in it, in a way. Mm-hmm. Yes, please.
Revolution as terror and the American Revolution as less terror. lying or not deserving of the emphasis the Raymond Carr gets, or the very suspicions of American leaders in the 1790s of a French terror of the revolution, that somehow maybe a Republican ideology or a Republican ideal in the 1790s dampened and mollified in the, you know, as a constitution.
That's a good question.
Yes. Thank you.
I mean, the question I draw from is what he began with, which is that, why is it that Hegel and Marx go more directly to the French Revolution than the American Revolution, and why is it that becomes the sign of history rather than the other one? I don't have a response, actually.
Maybe because of the difference in the principles, although the Declaration of Independence, but maybe less abstractly universal in the American Revolution. But it's a good question. At least today, since we forget, I mean, we tend to see terror as coming from outside. Mm-hmm. What Hegel forces us to see is terror from within, which I think just that little shift is an important political, debate, especially just coming back from France, and there you see really another perspective on America that see, terror from the American side, whereas here we see terrorism and terror as, always the outside and the unthinkable, irrational outside, whereas it could also belong to a certain kind of rationality within. This is something that Hegel suggests very, very strongly. Yes?
Well, I mean, I think that one of the things that one sees is the slippage that takes place around the word terror, right? And not just around the word terror, but around the terrorist, right? Who is the terrorist? What is the terrorist? And I think that the mobility of that term within contemporary discourse is quite impressive, so that you can become very easily identified with that term if you take this particular stance rather than that one. Even if you're here, you're not Muslim, it doesn't matter. You just become attached to that term, and it becomes a term that once you're attached to it, it becomes very difficult to dissociate yourself from it, right? I'm trying to remember, there was an advertisement in the New York Times about 2 years ago, and I don't know if I'll reconstruct it well, but I remember looking at it and thinking that I had actually seen it wrongly. But it was, when is a terrorist not a terrorist? And then what it was is when you are Palestinian, right? And it was an attack on U.S. press coverage of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. And I took a double take because, you know, when is a terrorist not a terrorist? And it's not represented that way within the media, but they were immediately turning it around in order to suggest that. And I think that one of the lessons of it, I mean, it's not just how it gets mobilized and used this way or that, but I think one of the things that comes out of a lot of the things that we've been talking about tonight is the inevitability of political complicity. And I think that is something that one needs to talk about more, because it's inevitable. It's absolutely inevitable. So you're not distinguishing between one stance that is absolutely clean and another one that isn't. What you're trying to do is differentiate between different degrees of contamination. And that's a much more difficult task, I think. You can even account for much of what happened by saying that the Democrats were terrified of being called terrorists. Okay. Right? I mean, I think that's part of the cowardice, I think.
Evan? Enthusiasm.
I was just saying that, and I was just thinking as you were speaking, the question of the avant-garde relative to the crowd, or just to say the level of products popular, the popular, it parallels the political problem of the vanguard, right? And it parallels the problems of Marxism, Leninism, with respect to the relationship between the party or the intellectuals and the people. Which we find already in Marx, or what is the connection between the intellectuals and the, you know, what he at one point calls the head and the heart, you know, the thinkers and the masses. And so, you know, it often is that the problems are often conceptualized in remarkably parallel terms, and even the vocabulary of the vanguard or avant-garde is the same. This isn't in any way an answer, it's just an elaboration on your question, I think, that the issue is political from the outset.
I'm always surprised by, you know, the use of crowd, and especially, you know, to translate this Canetti book, where for me it's always mass. Mm-hmm. And I know I betray, you know, my age and so on, but, you know, people who learn the international and so on, the international will be the genre humain in French, it's humankind, which presupposes some kind of universality via the mass that is not necessarily there to me, in the crowd, and you know, in German, Menge, Masse, not exactly the same, so there's the political crowd, as it were, that's slightly different, and that is, I think, presupposed by at least the French Revolution, somehow, that you need a crowd, you need a mass, but it will be identified as the entirety of, you know, universality, as it were, like the third estate that had been repressed because we were nothing. You quote this in your article, Say Yes, famous. We were nothing. We will be all. Okay? So you have to become all. And I think there's something of this in the current religious fundamentalism of certain groups that we know are not all, but it's part of the rhetoric to become all. So the in the representations of these masses in movement running in Eisenstein's films or Fritz Lang and so on, what you see is always this emblem of, you know, the multitude with all the faces that you cannot recognize that in a way become as a synecdoche, part of the whole. You see the whole somewhere in the back. Mm-hmm. And I think most of these revolutions we're talking about have this whole, the universality as a background, which is why they can be scary at times, but it's part of the dynamic, I think.
Can you have a revolution without this ghost or this call?
Probably not. I don't know. I don't think so. Even an artistic revolution, if anything like that exists, would have to be, in a way, born by the belief that there is the whole of humankind that will follow.
Precisely that refusal to abide by, to go along with the masses that we cherish, not the heart, when we idolize it in some sense, traditionally, or in the popular history of the heart, that stubborn refusal to reduce its primary to the
But the way that this is theorized and legitimated by leftist avant-gardist theorists, at least, such as, you know, Adorno being the prime, you know, prime position here, is that this term mass is of course important, where mass used generically as if it's all of humanity is a part term used as a total term. So what is the mass? What is presented as the mass is in fact a class which whose limitations are being obfuscated. So the discourse of mass, massification, has to do precisely with ideologies, sort of the veiling of class relations and class oppression. So insofar as, you know, society appears as a mass, you can be sure that it's divided. It's kind of in its homogeneity. It's divided and fissured and exclusive and marked by such exclusions. So when Marx, for example, basically repeats his logic in invoking here the German specifically the German proletariat as the class which is no class, it's no part, it's no partial class. Why? Because it has nothing. I mean, it's eviscerated of all content, and as such lies its supreme, you know, what he actually identifies with its philosophical capacity, its supreme capacity for abstraction, that is to say universality. It's nothing, and therefore it is the only part which can represent, which can be the perfect synecdoche of the whole, which can represent the whole entirely. We have the movement from, you know, the theological moment of ex nihilo creation, from zero to everything, which is the task that the German proletariat has to bear at this point. So in having nothing, it becomes everything, becomes representative of not this or that particular humanity, but just simply humanity in general. Mm-hmm. And that horizon of totality, which is by definition an abstract totality, a totality without qualities, because any qualities would differentiate it, is the horizon with which any thought of revolution properly can be conceived, insofar as it's the metaphysics of an ex nihilo creation or beginning. So I would say they're logically inseparable. otherwise you have partial, you know, you have reform changes if this or that.
If we have no more questions, thank you.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you for coming. Thank you.